Well, 1 Kings 7 continues the upward trajectory that we've seen over the six chapters of this book so far. We started with an ignorant, impotent, geriatric King David, and now we've come to a wise, glorious, strong King Solomon, immersed in his greatest project, building Yahweh's house. 3 weeks ago, chapter 6 took us on a tour of the temple, giving us an overview of its architecture, exterior, and major features. In future weeks, the bulk of chapter 7 will detail its furnishings, utensils, and equipment. But this week, we consider what seems like an odd interruption in this account of the temple, Solomon's construction of his own house. So as we read it together, ask yourself, what is this account doing here? 1 Kings 7, 1 through 12. Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished his entire house. He built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And it was built on four rows of cedar pillars, with cedar beams on the pillars. And it was covered with cedar above the chambers that were on the 45 pillars, 15 in each row. There were window frames in three rows and window opposite window in three tiers. All the doorways and windows had square frames, and window was opposite window in three tiers. And he made the hall of pillars. Its length was 50 cubits, and its breadth 30 cubits. There was a porch in front with pillars and a canopy in front of them. And he made the hall of the throne where he was to pronounce judgment, even the hall of judgment, which seems to be another name for the same building. It was finished with cedar from floor to rafters. His own house where he was to dwell and the other court back of the hall was of like workmanship. Solomon also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken in marriage. All these were made of costly stones, cut according to measure, sawed with saws back and front, even from the foundation to the coping, and from the outside to the great court. The foundation was of costly stones, huge stones, stones of 8 and 10 cubits, and above were costly stones, cut according to measurement and cedar. The great court had three courses of cut stone all around, and a course of cedar beams. So had the inner court of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the house. Well, this is the word of the Lord. I encourage you, please keep this text in front of you. May the Lord help us to understand, believe, and obey his word. Well, figuring out what this little tangent about Solomon's house is doing here at the beginning of chapter 7 is more challenging than you might think. I read through quite a few commentaries and some articles and books, and most were either indifferent, unsure, or at odds with each other when it comes to this question. Many pay only cursory attention to these verses, some giving it just a few paragraphs. Others offer a smattering of comments about details of architecture and translation, but have virtually nothing to say about the theological significance of this building project. And more than one acknowledged not being sure exactly what to make of this passage. One commentator, whom I usually find to be quite helpful, argued that the significance of this description of Solomon's building project, his house, lies entirely in its brevity. It's here simply to serve as a foil to the temple. He put it this way: by minimizing the space given the government buildings, the author magnifies the importance of the temple. So according to this reading, the application of this passage boils down to worship is more important than government. So in this interpretation, we're supposed to think of Solomon's house as symbolic of the swaggering pretensions of modern secular states who rival God in their attempt to answer every need of their citizens. And by squishing a brief account of Solomon's house between two beefy descriptions of the temple, sort of like making Gumby sit between Hulk Hogan and Arnold Schwarzenegger on the school bus, the narrator is implicitly reminding us that civil governments are mere dust bunnies on the cosmic scales compared to the mountain of Yahweh's presence with his people. And while I would certainly agree that there's something to the brevity of this account, the author here, he's hinting at the greater importance of the temple, I don't think it works to say that that's the main point of this passage. If it was, then why mention Solomon's house at all? In that case, wouldn't it serve the author's purpose far better to just ignore Solomon's house completely, or maybe reduce these 12 verses down to just verse 1, so the point's unmistakable? I mean, why luxuriate in all of this detail? Still less convincing is the association of Solomon's house with overweening secular governments. And while I'm personally sympathetic to the idea that modern states can and often do function like God replacements, I don't think that idea is remotely related to 1 Kings 7. After all, remember that the most distinctive feature of Israel's monarchy was its God-centeredness. This was pure 120-proof theocracy. Remember that the king of Israel was supposed to make his own priest-approved copy of God's law so he could rule according to its precepts. According to the terms of the Davidic covenant, Solomon was not a rival to or replacement for the Lord, but his representative and son. That interpretation just doesn't work. Now, the commentators who do pay a significant amount of attention to this passage, most read it as a kind of cautionary tale. This passage is here, so they say, to warn us about the dangers of selfishness, greed, vanity, disordered priorities, materialism. Solomon spent too much time and too much money on his own house to the point that he made it a greater priority than the Lord's house. Thus, this passage is seen to be foreshadowing Solomon's later turning away from the Lord. Along these lines, one commentator writes, "What is displayed here is far more Solomon's riches and honor than his wisdom." His was undoubtedly the piety of worldly success. Another commentator, one that I usually find to be very helpful, treats this text as a study in the temptations of distraction and extravagance, meant to remind us to prioritize God's house and God's kingdom and God's affairs over our own. And while I certainly agree, and I think that you would too, that selfishness, greed, distraction, and misplaced priorities are very real temptations for us, things we ought to pray and think about, I'm confident that that is not the point of this passage. Consider with me why it just doesn't work to read this passage as a cautionary tale. First, notice that the text never criticizes Solomon for his house-building project. If anything, the tone of this passage seems to be admiring, not critical. Again, it's helpful to ask, why are so many details included here? If the point of the passage is Solomon's vanity, greed, and self-indulgence, then why would the narrator luxuriate in descriptions of these buildings? Secondly, to claim that building an opulent house is conclusive evidence of deep-seated character flaws within Solomon is to ignore two very basic facts about Solomon's monarchy. The first is that having an opulent house was, and actually if you think about it, even now continues to be, the norm for kings and rulers. And you can't explain away this fact, you know, with a critique of class warfare, or a Puritan emphasis on plainness, or an ascetic appeal to self-denial, or a pietistic claim that the only riches we should ever have are immaterial and quote-unquote spiritual. A universal principle of politics is that the king represents his entire nation. And it follows from that principle that the type of house a king or ruler lives in says something about the type of nation that he represents. What would it say about the nation of Israel if Solomon lived in a shack, a mud hut, a cardboard box? We've already seen in recent weeks that Solomon was one of the chief glories of the nation of Israel. It only stands to reason that his house should in some way reflect that. But even more to the point, the claim that building an opulent house is conclusive evidence of deep-seated character flaws within Solomon ignores a second basic fact about Solomon's monarchy, which is that God himself promised to make Solomon the richest king that the world had ever seen. Remember how the Lord responded to Solomon's request for wisdom in chapter 3. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king can compare with you. How can we fault Solomon for having a sumptuous house when it was the Lord who made him the richest king the world had seen up to that point? Of course, the Bible does warn us in many places about the dangers of wealth, but it also tells us that the Lord is generous and that wealth can be both a temptation and a reward and blessing. In seminary, we were warned as future preachers about preaching the right doctrine from the wrong text. Faulting Solomon for having a nice house and riches in 1 Kings 7 seems to be a good example of doing that. Thirdly, why won't it work? To claim that Solomon spent more money on his own house than he did on the Lord's house is a very weak argument. Think about it with me. While it's true Solomon's house was bigger than the temple, and while it's true that some of the building materials were the same, cedar, costly stones, we must remember Solomon's house was not lined with gold like the Lord's house was. Do you remember what it says in 1 Chronicles 22? David saved up 100,000 talents of gold for the construction of the temple. According to Google's AI as of Friday, that is the equivalent of $556.2 billion in today's market. That's more, also according to AI, than the total inflation-adjusted cost of building the entire U.S. interstate road system. And remember, gold was only one layer of Solomon's temple. Fourthly, before we criticize Solomon for building an impressive house, we ought to think carefully about what the Bible actually means when it uses the terminology of house. If you'll read this passage carefully, you'll see the Bible actually speaks of Solomon's house in two different senses. In the wider sense, Solomon's house includes all five of the buildings described in this passage. That's the way the term's used in verse 1, also chapter 9, verse 10. Notice that when the Bible uses the term in this wider sense, it means something very different than what you and I usually mean when we talk about our houses. It means the entire complex of government buildings associated with Israel's monarchy. Along those lines, look again at verses 2 through 7. And notice how the first three buildings are actually given official names. From other places in the Bible, it seems that the Forest of Lebanon functioned as both an armory and a national treasury. You can find the footnotes in the back if you look for the references. It's less clear what function the Hall of Pillars served. Scholars conjecture this was probably a reception area or a waiting place for those who had come to stand before the king's throne, maybe a place of hospitality as well. And of course, verse 7 explicitly tells us that the hall of the throne was the place where Solomon heard cases and he made judgments, thus fulfilling one of the central duties of his office. In other words, while these three buildings were, it's true, physically connected to the place where Solomon actually lived, and they were identified as being part of Solomon's house in the wider sense, it's quite clear they were not built for his personal comfort or to stroke his pride. They were built for the welfare and glory of the entire nation of Israel. They were public buildings, official places where Solomon carried out his duties as the king. Think about it this way. When the Bible uses the term Solomon's house in this wider sense, it means essentially the same thing that we mean when we refer to the White House, which is to say the entire executive branch of the federal government, not just the personal residence of the current president. But even more to the point, look again with me at verse 8. And you'll see the Bible also knows how to use the term house in the narrower sense, the one we probably think of immediately, the sense of his personal residence. And what's particularly salient for our purposes in this sermon is to note that when the Bible does zoom in on Solomon's house, in this narrow sense of the word, where he lived, it gives almost no detail. Just one brief, sparse sentence, as if to say, oh, by the way, the place where Solomon actually lived was in the back corner of the government offices. You see, instead of revealing Solomon's supposed distraction and extravagance, I think a careful reading of this passage reveals almost the very opposite. The bulk of Solomon's house was public space, devoted to fulfilling his duties as Israel's protector, the armory, provider, the treasury, host, maybe the Hall of Pillars, and judge, the Hall of the Throne. That imagery is really worth meditating on. We don't have precise details of square footage of Pharaoh's house, or Pharaoh's daughter, and Solomon's house, but I think it's safe to say that Solomon devoted at least 3/5 of his own house to the service of God's people and to fulfilling his duties as their king. Christian, how do you use and how do you see your house? As a place of ministry? As a way to provide hospitality, protection, abundance, blessing to God's people? Or is it only all about your own comfort, ease, personal peace, just a place to escape from others? Fifthly, it's both mistaken and misleading to claim that the amount of time Solomon spent building his own house is clear evidence of a character flaw. Now, this, I think, is the most common argument for reading this passage as a cautionary tale. Many of you have probably heard some version of this interpretation. Look, Solomon spent almost twice as much time building his own house as he spent on the Lord's house. Clearly, he was prioritizing his own affairs, his own finances, his own glory over the Lord's. But that argument is mistaken for the simple reason that David had already spent years, maybe decades, preparing the way for Solomon to build the temple. Earlier, I referenced how much gold David had set aside for this project. But we ought to remember, David also prepared 1,000,000 talents of silver and bronze and iron beyond weighing, as well as timber and stone. And in 1 Chronicles 22, David told Solomon, "With great pains I have provided for the house of the Lord." And on top of all that just physical material, 1 Chronicles 28 tells us that David gave Solomon a detailed written blueprint for the temple and its major furnishings. So think about it this way. Given the amount of legwork that David had already done, you know, to prepare the way, he couldn't build a temple, but he did everything he could to prepare the way for Solomon to do it. It's really no surprise that Solomon was able to finish it in just 7 years. On the other hand, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, the Bible gives no indication that Solomon had a head start on his own house. But this idea that Solomon sinned, or at least is morally suspect, for spending a longer time in the construction of his own house than the Lord's house, is not just mistaken, but misleading. For one thing, it doesn't make much sense to argue that Solomon prioritized his own house over God's house. If you look at the end of chapter 6, in the beginning of chapter 7, the narrator actually seems to be telling us the exact opposite. It seems that Solomon first built the Lord's house, and secondly, built his own house. 1 Kings 9:1 and 9:10 also repeat this same order. The Lord's house first, Solomon's house second. But beyond that, we need to be careful with this idea that importance can be precisely quantified in terms of time. Of course, there must be some truth in that idea. I certainly agree that examining your life in terms of what you spend your time on can be a helpful yardstick for what your functional beliefs and priorities are. Surely it's deeply significant and deeply grievous that according to statistical data, Americans average over 7 hours a day on a screen, but only 2.4 minutes a day reading the Bible and praying. But we have to be careful that we don't push that kind of yardstick too far, that we don't turn it into a formula, as if the percentage of time that you spend on something precisely equals its importance or priority. Most of you, I hope, would agree with me when I say that while sleep is very important, gathering with God's people for worship on the Lord's Day is a higher priority. And yet, even if you spend 7 hours of your week here each Sunday, you know, between Sunday school and socializing and Sunday morning and Sunday evening, that's still probably only about 13% of the hours you will spend sleeping in an average week. Does that mean you're failing to prioritize worship? Does the priority of worship mean you need to spend at least as much time in church as you do sleeping? Or consider the tithe. I hope that most of you would agree that one of the highest financial priorities for the Christian, maybe the highest or the first, is to give to the Lord. But does that priority mean that we have to put at least as much in the offertory plate as we spend on the rent, mortgage, groceries, or paying down debts? No, because priorities can't be measured precisely in formulas. No, because as Pastor Rayburn pointed out in his sermon on this same passage in May of 2010, very helpful, God is glorified not only in our worship and tithe, but in our faithful efforts to fulfill our various callings in every area of life. And no, because our God is a generous God. True, he could demand that we spend 6 days a week in church and just allow us one for our work and our recreations and whatever else. True, he could require us to give him 90% of our wealth and only allow us 10% to live on. He would have every right to do so. And in the case of the rich young ruler, he actually demanded 100% of his wealth. But that is not his normal way. Ordinarily, his way is to require the first fruits of our time and money, and then to give us freedom within the constraints of his law and within the context of us knowing that we are stewards who are to use what we have for his glory and who will give an account. This morning's parable of the vineyard could serve to illustrate the point. While working in the vineyard was demanding, and while the servants were accountable to the master wasn't a tyrannical taskmaster, standing over them at every minute with a time chart, making sure that it fit a formula. Nor was he a penny pincher or a fussy killjoy. After all, he turned the servants loose in a vineyard, a beautiful place of abundance. And in the same way, as we think about Solomon's house, we ought to remember that the Lord is our Father, and he is a good Father who delights in showering gifts upon his children. But there's a sixth and a final reason why it just won't work to read this passage as a cautionary tale. And once again, I need to tip my hat to Pastor Rayburn and also to commentator Peter Lighthart for the inspiration behind this point, which I think is actually the deepest reason. Because glory is not a zero-sum game. To argue that the mere fact of Solomon building and owning a glorious house necessarily puts him in competition with the glory of the Lord is to assume a false concept of glory. It's to treat glory as a limited substance in a system where getting glory necessarily means taking glory from someone else. So in the classic board game Monopoly, the main way to get money, to get property, to get more houses, is to take them from your opponents. Technically, it's not a zero-sum game because you can get more money from the bank, but it's very much like it, for those of you who are engineers and board game nerds. The only way to get the glory of winning in Monopoly is by making everyone else go bankrupt. But friends, the glory of God is not a zero-sum game. He doesn't need to make his children go bankrupt in order to win. His glory is inexhaustible. Like a mirror reflecting the light back to the sun, Solomon's glory only made his heavenly Father's glory more visible to the entire world. Consider with me how the Lord shared his own glory with Solomon here in this passage. First, he let Solomon live near him. Other passages of Scripture make it clear that Solomon's house was very close to the Lord's house. In fact, 2 Chronicles 9 implies they were physically connected by a stairway. It's very hard to imagine living next door to Taylor Swift, Michael Jordan, George W. Bush, Oprah Winfrey, or Elon Musk. Celebrities, billionaires, and powerful political figures seem to live in a world of their own. But the maker of heaven and earth was willing to share a duplex with Solomon and call him his son. Secondly, the Lord shared his glory by allowing Solomon to live under him. Again, 2 Chronicles 9:4 helps us understand the literal architecture, the geographic relationship, Solomon's house and Yahweh's house. If you look at it in the KJV or the NASB, you'll see the verse explains Solomon's house was just a little bit beneath. Solomon had to literally ascend a staircase to get to the temple. That architecture, of course, symbolized the spiritual reality that the Lord is the most exalted one, the highest authority and power. But it also pointed to the fact that Solomon was under Yahweh. He ruled under him as his representative, his co-regent, his son. Thirdly, the Lord allowed Solomon to imitate him. If you pay just careful attention to some of the architectural details of this passage here, you'll see several ways in which Solomon consciously patterned his own house on the tabernacle and the temple. The most compelling point is right at the end of our passage, where it tells us, "So the inner court of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the house," makes the connection explicit. But you can see it in other ways as well, and we'll explore some of those, Lord willing, next week when we look at Jachin and Boaz and think about the pillars here in the Hall of Pillars. But for now, I'll just point them out without much commentary. Both Solomon's house and the temple were built of cedar and precious stone. Both featured decorative pillars. Both the house of the Forest of Lebanon and the tabernacle courtyard were 100 cubits by 50 cubits, 100 long, 50 wide. Although Solomon's house included a total of 5 buildings, our text here emphasizes there were really 3 main rooms, just like the tabernacle and the temple had 3 main areas. And if you look at the 3 named buildings here, there seems to be a progression, just like there was a progression to the 3 rooms of tabernacle and temple. The Hall of Pillars seems to correspond to the courtyard. The House of the Forest of Lebanon seems to correspond to the holy place with all of its sacred furnishings. And the throne room very clearly corresponds to the Holy of Holies, which, of course, was where God's throne, the Ark, stood. And fourthly, how did the Lord share his glory with Solomon? He shared it with him by moving in at the same time. As one theologian pointed out, if you compare this text, chapter 9, verse 10, It seems clear that even though the Lord's house was finished long before Solomon's house was, he waited for Solomon to finish his own house before he moved in. They moved in at the same time. It ought to be clear to us that the Lord was not stingy with his glory. He lavished it upon Solomon, the one whom he had called to be his vice regent and son. But Christian, in the gospel of Jesus Christ, God's generosity is only multiplied exponentially. Because in his son, the ultimate son of David, he has not only shared his house, but his very divine nature. Jesus Christ does not simply live near God or under God. He is God. He is the God-man. And what's more, Christian, you are in Christ. You are united to that divine glory. His glorious spirit dwells within you so that you can always be near the glory of God. In the hours before Jesus went to the cross, he prayed specifically for you, those who would believe in him in the future. Listen to how he prayed. The glory that you have given to me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and you in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved them, even as you loved me. Christian, this is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Not only justification and sanctification, but glorification. Believe it and rejoice. Amen.